Hey, what's going on? It's At The Letters, presented by Miller Lite, the original light beer. Today is Monday, August the 9th. My name's Arden Zwelling. That is Ben Nicholson-Smith, and our producers this week are Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. And Ben, the Blue Jays, coming off of like the homestand of all homestands. First games at Rogers Center in nearly 2 years. They win 9 of 11. They win tight ball games. They win blowouts. They have a walk-off. They have comeback victories. You even expand it into the greater context of the season. Blue Jays have won 10 of 12. 16 of 24, 27 of 42, 643 winning percentage since June 19th, best in the American League. This is a good vibes podcast, man, because there are not a lot of bad vibes to be found around this club.
Not at all. I mean, what an incredible start. What an incredible return to Toronto. It almost couldn't have gone better. You think about this weekend, and you know, not only are they winning these games, but as you said, they're doing it in very memorable fashion. Like, they had that 9-run inning on Friday.
Swing and a line drive down the left field line, hooking into the corner, and that is a fair ball. Kirk comes home to score. Grichuk's in to score.
And the ball. Then the Semien walk-off on Saturday.
Semien goes after the first pitch, high and deep to left. Get up, get out of here, and gone! Game winner for Marcus Semien, his first career walk-off.
Then on Sunday, a massive comeback win with homers from Vladdy and George Springer.
Springer drives it in the air, deep left field. You can forget it! A go-ahead three-run homer for George Springer! The Blue Jays are all the way back!
It's honestly like the way that you would draw it up. And as you said, it fits into a bigger picture of this team playing really well for an extended period of time. You just look at the roster, they're a good team. They're a very, very good baseball team. And they have a very good chance right now to make the playoffs. And once they're there, who knows what happens. Still a lot of work to be done, but they are in an excellent position as they head west.
And this was like very nearly the perfect homestand, because when you look at the two losses, so the most recent one was game two of the doubleheader on Saturday against the Red Sox. Blue Jays lose that one in extras in the eighth inning of a seven-inning game. That game was tied going into extra innings. They lose it by one run. And then you look at the loss prior to that, which was against Cleveland. I think it was like the first game of that series. Another extra innings loss. Brad Hand serves up a three-run shot to Jose Ramirez. Again, a game that was tied going into extras. The Blue Jays were two big swings away from this being a perfect homestand and truly one of the more remarkable things I've seen.
Yeah, it was really cool to watch. And we touched on this in our last episode, but even just to see the fans being able to return to Toronto and the players and the managers, the coaching staff, finally being able to settle in with some amount of certainty, with some amount of support from the crowd, even though it's obviously a limited capacity crowd. So it was really cool to see that and to allow the fans, you know, regardless of where the season leads, because they might go on a losing streak or they might have injuries come up, but that homestand was really a special one for this team and for this franchise. And to go 9-2, to play some really excellent baseball, Springer really endears himself, I think, to the home crowd and the fan base. And Vladdy hits his first home runs in Toronto as, you know, the real Vladdy that we've come to know him as. I thought it was really cool and just an amazing moment and series of moments for Canadian baseball fans and for Toronto baseball fans, for Blue Jays fans. And I do think that it's going to lead to more special places and more memorable places. But if not, this homestand, even in and of itself, was pretty wild.
You mentioned the crowd, and I was wrong. I thought that only 15,000 in the dome, you know, would have a sort of mid-September Blue Jays are out of it Wednesday night and Cleveland's in town kind of feel. And there would be somewhat of an unengaged, well, not engaged, but like that 15,000 people just could not replicate 50,000, just could not make that place feel full and just could not bring the same amount of energy, because you're 15,000 people in this like monolith, this massive coliseum of a stadium. I was wrong. 15,000 people have brought all kinds of energy, and 15,000 have felt like 50,000 at times. I wonder what 50,000 would feel like in there right now. I hope that we get there at some point, but like full mark, full credit to the crowd, which has brought the energy every single night and sustained it through games and through a long homestand. I'm curious for your take on this. Do you believe that that impacts performance? Like, do you believe that the Blue Jays are playing better during this homestand to some degree because of the crowd and because of the support that they are receiving? Or can you not quite logically get there?
I would say to a small extent, yes. I think to a large extent, you have a certain amount of ability and skill that you've built up over the course of years. And, you know, if you put Jared Hoying in the outfield instead of George Springer, doesn't matter how hard the crowd is cheering. It just doesn't. You know, it's still Jared Hoying. I think, though, the fact that the Blue Jays say that it's making a difference and they seem to be enjoying it, and, you know, they finally have some stability from a mental standpoint. They know what to expect and what to anticipate, where they're going to be. I think absolutely that would help to some small incremental amount. And I don't know exactly what percentage that would be. I'd guess, you know, 2 or 3 percentage points. I mean, I don't think it's a huge difference by any stretch. Maybe you see it differently, but to me, I think it would be definitely, it's positive. Definitely, it's good. And you can't be in a position, if you're playing close games, to turn your nose up at a couple percentage points. So I'm not trying to say that's not significant or not helping. But I think at the same time, a lot of it is, you know, who's on your roster. And the Jays happen to have a great roster.
I agree. But there was a little bit of this homestand that made me believe in the magic just a bit, just from being there. And as you said, you know, talking to the players, hearing them talk about it, the coaches, the staff, everybody around the team, and just witnessing it, right? And as a, you know, pretty logical, sort of empirical left brain kind of guy, like as somebody who likes there to be evidence and like measurable, quantifiable reasons for things to happen, I still believe that these are just professional athletes and that the incentives are great no matter where the games are being played, because these are paychecks on the line. These are livelihoods. And if you don't perform and you don't succeed, somebody's liable to take that paycheck away. And even just as a professional athlete, like your window for earning that paycheck is incredibly finite. And you've worked extremely hard to get to where you are now. So you have, regardless of whether where these games are being played, Buffalo, Dunedin, Mars, you have incredible incentives to play well and to perform. But what did we just see, man? You know, like we just saw that home advantage was real and that there was something there. Like, I just think it's extremely hard to deny after watching this team for the first 3.5-4 months of the season and then watching them for the last 10 days that they derived some sort of energy and some sort of boost to their performance from that home crowd.
Agreed. I mean, the crowd helped for sure. And it was really cool to see the crowd, you know, serenade Vladdy with the MVP chants, just the whole homestand. He obviously deserves it the way he's playing this year. And just the atmosphere was really good. I would agree with you. And I mean, this might sound like a really, you know, old person thing to say, but even being back there, I was struck by how loud it was, you know, after 18 months of, you know, basically not going to events at all, let alone events in a stadium. You know, it was, wow, like this is loud. And partly maybe it's the new sound system, but partly it was the fans who were making a lot of noise, even with the dome open and open air, lots of air circulation happening, of course. And that's a great thing. But man, the fans were loud and it was cool. You know, as someone who's obviously been to lots of games at Rogers Center over the years under very different circumstances, and this was its own unique circumstance, but it's definitely not a homestand I'll forget anytime soon when you think about this franchise.
Like, even if it's only like a placebo effect, right, Ben? Yeah. Like, even if that's the players just believe that they're deriving something from it, well, the placebo effect is real. Like, that's been observed, and there are proven psychological benefits neurologically. The placebo effect, like, impacts your hormones and your dopamine, your endorphins, like, the brain responds to it. So if the Blue Jays hitters believe that they are feeling less stress and anxiety or more support, like more comfortable at the plate, if their pitchers feel that they're concentrating better and just dialing in more and focusing more on their execution, if they believe that their opponents are feeling more pressure and more stress and are less at ease in these situations, there's real impact there. And like you said, that might only be a percentage point or two towards the Blue Jays on a given night, But at this level, that little marginal gain can make a difference because it's MLB. Like the margins are super, super thin. It's the highest level of competition in the world. So, and then just like anything else in life, like you add up those little marginal gains every day, those little tiny little wins each and every night. And over time, they compound and they add up and it becomes something much more meaningful in the long run.
That's right. And I think, you know, to me, if there was a moment that this really manifested on the field, I think it was Friday night when the Blue Jays chased Ovaldi from the game with 7 runs. Then on comes Hansel Robles. And at that point, he hits Grichuk, in my opinion, intentionally. I mean, other people might view it differently, but come on, he hit him on purpose. And so, you know, at that point, the crowd is enraged. They're letting Robles have it, as they should.
And Rando gets hit. And that's kind of suspect. Robles, new to the Red Sox, comes in and hits Grichuk. And now the Blue Jays are upset. And everybody's coming out of the game. And Cora gets to Robles.
And he was rattled. Like, it was, to me, it just seemed obvious. And, you know, I'm by no means an expert at reading body language. It's not my expertise. But, you know, you just watch him out there and you see the situation that he's in. How could he not be rattled? And then, boom, Jays keep scoring off him. They keep adding on. Not saying those runs made the difference in the series by any stretch, but I think that's an example of seeing the kind of impact the crowd can actually make.
And I would even point to the Sunday game, which is obviously fresh in our minds because it just happened. But there were so many points in that game where the Blue Jays could have packed it in. Hyunjin Ryu comes out and lays a rare egg, and the Blue Jays are down 7-2 after 3 or whatever it was. And then there is an early point in the third or fourth inning where I think Springer gets aboard and Vladdy gets aboard. And Marcus Semien has this terrible call go against him at the end of like a 10 pitch plate appearance. He's like fouled off 5 pitches and he's really, really battled. And he's taken a clear ball off the plate for a walk, but it's called a strike and he strikes out. And it completely reverses the dynamic of that inning and completely just evaporates a potential rally. And then again, later in the game, in the 7th, Blue Jays are trying to rally against Adam Ottavino, and Teoscar Hernandez gets thrown out trying to advance to third on a ground ball to short. Corey Dickerson gets picked off at second. Ottavino off the hook. Red Sox out of the inning. Blue Jays rally killed. Like, there were so many points in that game where the Blue Jays could pack it in, and where over the first half of the season, we've seen them pack it in and we've seen them lose those games. How many times have we seen the Blue Jays drop games like that? Have we seen their bullpen not keep them in those spots? And have we seen Blue Jays hitters fail to execute in late and close situations? And what happens this time? Breivik Valera, of all people, comes up with a clutch single. Reese McGuire works probably one of the better plate appearances I've ever seen him have at the big league level. 9 pitches against Matt Barnes and gets on base with a walk. And then obviously George Springer comes up and has this epic at bat against Barnes, who like is his bro from back in the day. Like, these guys grew up together, roomed in college, know each other really well. Obviously, like, he knows Barnes's repertoire super well. When there's that much familiarity, it's always hard to tell if that benefits the hitter or the pitcher. It depends on the matchup. But here, I mean, Springer just got to a pitch that he can drive and like absolutely pulverized it and could not miss it and executed in a late and close situation. Like, the Blue Jays exercised so many demons in that game. You know, I do wonder if the atmosphere and the surroundings and the environment had something to do with them staying in that game for as long as they did and ultimately coming out on top of it in a game that we saw them lose with avoidable errors and own goals over and over again over the first half of the season.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a big difference between what we saw when they were playing in Dunedin in front of Yankees fans or Rays fans. So you can't help but wonder, for sure. And I think, you know, one thing that you pointed to there is really telling, right? Because you mentioned McGuire and Valera contributing. And that wasn't the only time in the course of this weekend or this homestand where they had guys from the back end of the roster, back part of the lineup, who were really stepping up. So you could add in Alejandro Kirk or Randall Grichuk, who's now, you know, one of those 7, 8, 9 hitters for this team. And they were stepping up on a regular basis. And at that point, like, it becomes almost unfair for the opposition because, you know, 1 through 5, they're so stacked. They're so good. Like, we could spend whole podcast talking about Vladdy and Springer, whose homestand was just otherworldly. And, you know, his numbers are outrageous for the season, for the homestand. But then you got Semien and Bo. Like, they're just Teoscar. It's such a deep lineup and it's such a good team. Like, this is, they just keep coming back to it. They got six starting pitchers that are good. By the time some people listen to it, that'll be five, obviously, with Stripling likely bumped. But, you know, they have such a good team. And it's not perfect. They have flaws in the bullpen. But I don't think that this is the last of the Blue Jays' hot streak. I don't think that what we saw over the course of that homestand was a flash in the pan. I'm not saying they'll go 9-2 all the time. But this is a ball club that can and will replicate success to, I think, a pretty considerable extent. Like, I think they're headed toward the playoffs at this point. And doesn't mean they'll get there. But at this point, it just feels like that's where they're headed.
Well, and we've been saying it for so long, is that at some point the Blue Jays are going to have to go on a run. Right? And at some point they're going to have to stop just sort of hovering 3 to 5 games above 500 and spin their wheels a little bit at that point and actually start piling up wins at a pretty good rate. Well, the Blue Jays no longer have to go on a run. They have to sustain a run. Because as I said, since June 19th, completely arbitrary endpoint, chosen purely to make the argument like as convincing as possible in like probably unfair or, you know, dishonest way. But since June 19th, 643 win percentage, top in the American League. That's a meaningful sample of 42 games. So you just have to sustain that over the final 52 games. And all of a sudden you've won like way more than 90 games. And you're not only likely in a wild card position, but you're likely hosting the wild card game, which would be unbelievable to see at Rogers Center. Obviously, there's no guarantees of that. Blue Jays have to stay healthy. They have to stay productive. Their starters have to continue to be as good as they have been. Their bullpen has to stabilize and they need to reinforce that bullpen in a pretty big way. A lot of things have to go right. And as we've seen in a baseball season, there are always lulls. There are always cold streaks. And there are always times when things aren't going to go your way and not everything's going to look as charmed as it has over the last 10 days. But the Blue Jays are on the run and they've been on the run for a while. And now it is just about sustaining that and continuing what they have done over the last 42 games. And then we're probably looking at a team that's returned to the postseason.
That's right. I mean, you mentioned that date, whatever it was, late June 19th, June 19th. Something like that. And I mean, it's arbitrary to an extent, but it's also basically when George Springer came back. So, I mean, right. You know, the full version of this team, that's what we're looking at. And I don't think they're going to sustain quite that much, but it's also, you know, it's not a coincidence that you add Springer, this, you know, MVP caliber player when he's healthy and at his best, and you add him to this lineup. I mean, it's really a great group of position players. And at this point, being 10 games above 500 as we record this, even if they play 500 baseball for the rest of the year, they're 86-76. So that's not where you want to be, but you add on a little bit here and a little bit there. Like, it's not like they have to play some crazy level of baseball to get to 90 wins, to be in that conversation the whole season. So it really sets up an interesting, you know, 7-8 weeks remaining from here to the end of the regular season.
Well, George Springer's put up 1.7 F WAR already.
Wow.
This season in 43 games, which is remarkable. Like, he's been even more impactful than, you know, it's been complete best case scenario getting back, really. Like, I know he didn't quite look like himself when he came back, but he has more than made up for it with back-to-back player of the week weeks. And, like, you know, you look at that hit on Sunday and that home run, it's no exaggeration to call that the biggest hit of the Blue Jays season, to call that an absolute game winner. Like, he won that game for the Toronto Blue Jays. That was the win expectancy swing on that hit was like 60-70%. It was enormous. And that's just what George Springer has meant to this club. And there's been, beyond just his pure performance, there's been an impact on the lineup as well, as you were alluding to. He sets the tone at the top. These are all kind of like the old sports writer cliche type of things, but it really does feel like his plate appearances are really trickling down to Vladimir Guerrero Jr. in the two hole and Marcus Semien behind him and Bo Bichette at four and Teoscar Hernandez at five. It really does feel like George Springer has a serious plan at the plate and a serious idea of what he's looking to do every time he goes up, and that hitters behind him are learning from that and watching that and using it to their own advantage. It feels like George Springer is just chipping away at every starting pitcher that he faces and just fatiguing them and making them throw more pitches. When's the last time you saw a George Springer plate appearance that only went three pitches, right? When's the last time you saw him strike out on three pitches? When's the last time you saw him and you're like, ooh, this guy is in between, right? Or he is like clearly looking fastball and waving at breaking balls, right? Or he is sitting off speed and getting beat by heaters, or he doesn't look comfortable. Like, you just haven't seen it. Like, you have seen him truly kind of control the game from the batter's box and just be in complete command of his plate appearances. Like, it's abstract and it's intangible, but I think it's a very real thing that he's brought to this lineup since he's been back in it every day.
It's been great. Yeah, I mean, he's a $150 million player doing $150 million things, right? These are not skills that are easy to find, and he has them. I mean, you even think about how well he's moving recently, and, you know, there's a ball at one point on the weekend that kind of snuck past a couple outfielders, and so he was expecting second base, and he ends up keeping on going and makes it to third without any apparent hesitation, without any apparent issues. So that's a huge development compared to a couple months ago. And this contract, obviously, they did it for the long term. They did it because they want him to be a core piece, and that's what he is. But for a while, it kind of looked like he was going to have to make up some value later in the contract, as in like later years, but he's just doing it later months. You know, he's still having a really good year.
Yeah. Do you think he'll be a $25 million player this year?
Interesting. So I guess he'd have to get to about what, 3 WAR to do that?
Basically. Yeah. Do you think he's got another win and a half in him over this final? He might, right?
I think he does. And then if you throw in playoffs, which of course is, you know, part of the reason they acquire him, former World Series MVP, someone who can hit the best pitchers in the world. Like, he's got a chance for this year to be, it's not the steal that the Marcus Semien or the Robbie Ray deal would be, but this year has a chance to be very fair value.
But that's the thing, right? Like, when you sign George Springer, you're always thinking, we're going to get our best return on investment towards the beginning of this thing, and then maybe the last couple of years of it. The six-year deal for an outfielder in his 30s, maybe the last couple of years of it don't look that great. Historically, that's been the case for most guys who sign deals at that point in their careers anyway. And then George Springer misses the first half of the year, and you say, well, yeah, are you going to get your return on investment this year? Yeah, you might in only half a season, which, like, on the one hand is incredible and a really good outcome for the Blue Jays. But on the other hand, just points to how different this season would look if they had had George Springer every day for the first 3 months of the season. Maybe the Blue Jays aren't so historically bad in late and close games. Like, maybe they are a bit better defensively. Maybe some of those one run losses become one run wins. And maybe the Blue Jays right now are like well elevated in the standings from where they actually do sit today in real life.
It's entirely possible. It really is. And so, you know, I think that's a fair point. I think you look at the talent that they have right now, Springer full health, Berríos, who they only had a couple outings from, both good, both, you know, really encouraging. But, you know, this team is as good as it's been. It's better than it's been at any point in the last 5 years. Like, that's easy to say. I mean, it's such a dramatically different team than the last one that played at Rogers Center in 2019. They are a very, very good baseball team. And it sets up what I think is going to be a really interesting finish. Even this week, you know, Angels, Mariners, couple big series. They've got a chance to keep making up ground. And the way they're playing, I mean, they can face anyone. The rest of their schedule in August is actually sort of favorable, it appears, with some games against Detroit and Washington and Baltimore. But honestly, you could put this team up against the Dodgers or the Padres, and they'd have a real shot. The White Sox, the Astros, I don't think they're quite there. Like, the White Sox and Astros, to me, still are the two best teams in the American League. But after that, it's probably Rays and Blue Jays for me.
Yeah, there's kind of like a top tier, right? Of like, yeah, White Sox, Astros. I would probably throw the Rays in that tier as well, just based on results. But then there's a second tier of like Blue Jays, Red Sox, Yankees, Oakland. And I think the Blue Jays are atop that second tier and challenging to be included in that first tier, depending on if they can continue doing what they've been doing over the last several weeks.
Agreed. I think that's totally fair, right? I think we saw it this weekend. They're better than the Red Sox. We've been saying that for a while. doesn't mean they have the better record, because they don't, but they're a better team. And I think that they're right there with the Yankees, probably better than the Yankees right now. And they're right there with the Rays too. I mean, I think the Rays, you know, you look at base runs, which is like another degree of precision added on to Pythagorean, and the Jays are right there with the Rays as far as best outcomes in the American League. And, you know, just behind Padres, Dodgers, White Sox, Astros, they're not far off that elite tier in Major League Baseball.
And you look at sort of just the very basic runs scored and runs against, right? Like Blue Jays have been top five, sometimes top three in runs scored. They've been top 10 in runs against. Pretty good formula. You keep that going, you ought to win more games than you lose over a large sample. But you look at how the Blue Jays compare to the Rays. So the Blue Jays have scored 571 runs this year. Tampa Bay scored 570. Blue Jays have allowed 448 runs. Rays have allowed 449.
Wow.
They're right.
That's pretty
there,
telling.
Right? Neck and neck. So yeah, these two teams are competitive with one another. So maybe that means either I should have the Blue Jays up in that first tier with the Rays, or I should have the Rays down in that second tier with the Blue Jays. I don't know. But these two teams have had very similar seasons, but the Rays obviously have been able to convert more of that run differential into wins. Like, it's been the story of Blue Jays season. Like, they just have not been able to convert their run differential into real tangible wins, into results. And hey, maybe this return to Rogers Center and that like 1-2% edge that we were talking about, maybe that's the difference. I don't know. We're going to see.
100%. I mean, they're making up for some lost time right now and winning some of those close games. So that's the position you want to be in as you head into the last stretch of the season.
Good Vibes Podcast. And we will continue after this, take a look at the Blue Jays rotation, talk about the bullpen, and poke some holes in this team, because there are still some holes to be poked. So all that and much more, and we continue on At The Letters. It continues on At The Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson Smith, and it is time now for Keeping It Light, presented by Miller Lite. And want to use our Keeping It Light time this week, Ben, just to give a little appreciation to a guy who somehow just still slips under the radar, and that is Marcus Semien. Just a steady, calm, mature, veteran, impactful presence on this team throughout the season, shows up with his lunch pail every day, puts in a full effort, never wants to come out of a game, never wants a day off. And oh, by the way, the best position player in baseball since the year 2019. Since the beginning of the 2019 season, Marcus Semien leads all MLB position players in F4. 13.5 wins above replacement, and that includes a 2020 season, which was well down by the standards they set in 2019 and reinforced here in 2021. Think about that. Pick any position player in the game, Mookie Betts, Xander Bogaerts, Mike Trout, who you want. Marcus Semien's got more war than all of them. The only guy he's trailing in war in that time is Jacob deGrom, who has 14.5 and is the best pitcher any of us have ever seen in quite some time. Marcus Semien deserves more love than he gets, Ben.
100%. And even, you know, you look at the WAR leaderboard for this year, and of course, we know who's number one on that leaderboard. It's Vlad Guerrero Jr. But who's number two? It's Marcus Semien among qualified position players. So that tells you how good he is right now. You pointed out how good he has been consistently in the last 3 years. And in the here and the now, this one-year deal that he signed with the Blue Jays for $18 million, could not be going any better for the Jays. He's got 26 home runs. You mentioned the consistency. He's great on the bases with good speed and good instincts, good decisions. You look at the overall package and you have a player who is elite in Major League Baseball. And I think on this Blue Jays team, it's not that he gets totally overlooked. I think fans are well aware of what he brings, and certainly he got a deserving All-Star nod. But when you have Bo Bichette and Vlad Jr., when you have George Springer doing what he's been doing, it is easy to some extent to overlook Semien. So he deserves, you know, all the credit that he gets as a huge part of this team and a huge reason they're playing as well as they are right now.
And you mentioned how well this deal's worked out for the Blue Jays. Like, this deal almost didn't happen for the Blue Jays. Like, this almost went in a very different direction. Marcus Semien had options this winter. And that's, of course, because look, MLB front offices kind of know what they're doing and they kind of know who they're acquiring. So there were a lot of teams who were in on him. He could have gone back to Oakland. It would have been like a $12.5 million deal. A lot of that money deferred. It wasn't a great offer, especially considering what he gave that organization and what he meant to that Bay Area community at large. But it was an option, and he actually would have preferred likely to go back to Oakland. He's from there, grew up there, lived his entire life there, went to school there at Berkeley. Family is from there. Wife is from there. Kids have laid down roots there. The whole deal. But financially, wasn't going to happen. Minnesota Twins were in on him at $14 million in a year, and the opportunity to continue playing short, by the way, and not have to change position. The Dodgers were in on him to play third base. The Reds were in. The Giants were in. I mean, the Blue Jays had to compete for Marcus Semien. They had to sell him on the franchise, on the situation of likely starting away from Toronto, maybe Dunedin, maybe Buffalo, maybe he'll get to Toronto, who knows. The Semiens had a newborn at the time. They have three kids. They had this like big, long Zoom call during the offseason with, you know, Ross Atkins and Charlie Montoyo and Shannon Curley, who is the player relations coordinator with the Blue Jays, was on that call. Mike Murov, a member of the Blue Jays front office, was on it because he grew up like not that far from Marcus Semien in the Bay Area and was able to talk about transplanting from there to Toronto and like what the experience of life in Toronto is going to be like. And, you know, the Blue Jays and Marcus Semien's reps actually went pretty far down the road on a 4-year deal, like on longer term. So this was very nearly like a much bigger contract than it ended up being. Financially, they couldn't get there. And it ended up just making the most sense for both sides to do 1 year and $18 million. And I think that's worked out great for both sides because the Blue Jays have gotten this like really impactful veteran on the field and off, and they have maintained their flexibility financially going forward, whereas Semien has had this like great reestablish your value year, is now able to re-enter free agency after this year, yes, with a qualifying offer very likely tied around his neck, which will suppress his market, but still well positioned to get paid as he deserves to be as a premium up the middle player and one of the best bats in the majors at his position. It's worked out really well for both sides and almost didn't happen. It's kind of funny to look back on the history and trace the turns and twists that led us to get to this point.
Super interesting. Yeah. And I mean, you think about that 4-year deal. I bet the Jays wish that had been completed the way things are going right now. You'd love to have 3 more years of Marcus Semien. The way his season is going, he's going to have the chance to sign a deal that's more than 3 years this offseason. And it's interesting. You look at the group of free agent shortstops, and everyone talks so much about Carlos Correa and Javi Baez and Trevor Story, and well, Francisco Lindor was in that group for a while, now he's not, Corey Seager. So it's a really excellent class, but I think often overlooked is the fact that Marcus Semien will be hitting free agency among them. And to me, Correa is probably the number one guy because of his youth and just the talent. I mean, the sheer talent that he brings. But Semien's probably the number two guy, in my opinion, as things stand right now, because someone like Story not having a great year, Baez, you know, he's been okay, hasn't been amazing. Seager's missed some time. So I think that Semien's going to be in tons of demand. He's positioned himself extremely well. The Jays obviously should try to re-sign him. I expect that they will have that conversation when the time is right. But man, what a great, as you said, win-win deal for both sides.
Perpetually overlooked, dude. When he finished third in MVP voting 2 years ago, he wasn't even an all-star that year. Like, imagine that, finishing third MVP voting, but you're not even, you know, not an all-star. How many players become all-stars? They're just kind of like so-so guys, right? Like, and it's because Marcus Semien just doesn't bring that attention on himself. Like, I relate to the guy, like, as an introvert, just kind of, you know, he doesn't want that attention. He's just quiet, reserved, just wants to stick to himself, show up, do his job, go home, right? Don't want to ruffle any feathers. Don't want to be, you know, big look at me on social media, any of this stuff. Like, you know, isn't putting himself front and center, like very just team first, like get the job done, business oriented dude. And those kind of guys end up kind of getting overlooked. Those quiet professionals just show up and do the job well.
every day, but you just look at the results, right? You look at a 132 weighted runs created plus. You look at nearly a 5-win season at this point. I mean, you look at a pretty high batting average for this era, 274, a 337 OBP and a 528 slug, a bunch of pop, premium up the middle defense from a guy who committed like 100 errors in his rookie season as a shortstop and rebuilt himself defensively, a guy who's continued to get better year after year after year, and who came off of 2020 when he was hurt, like had a serious oblique issue that was preventing him from like even taking batting practice because like it just hurt to swing a bat that much, and he was having to spend so much time on the trainer's table. Like he would take 15 swings in the tunnel and then just step in and face the best pitching in the world. Like, good luck being successful if you can't even work on your swing like that, but was still playing shortstop every day and contributing to a playoff club with the Oakland Athletics, and then came into the postseason and like just went on the tear of all tears, and then came into 2021 and proved to everyone, no, 2019 was not a fluke. I am this guy. Like, I have made myself that good through just hard work and diligent effort and showing up every day and making those marginal improvements day after day after day, and let it lead to something bigger. He is just perpetually overlooked. And yeah, very interested to see how his free agency plays out this winter.
Yeah, he's put himself in a great position. And you know, you think about how this deal was framed by people like ourselves and others entering the season, and it was kind of, hey, this is a one-year deal, and then after that, you have, at the time, Austin Martin and Jordan Groshans and, you know, Aurelius Martinez, who since probably emerged as the Jays' best prospect. So you got this infield depth coming up through the system. Semien's here for 2021. But now, yes, they still have those guys coming up, and yes, those are exciting players, but I don't know that taking Marcus Semien off the roster is something you do lightly, you know? Like, of course you make him the qualifying offer, but I think the Jays need to be in on him this offseason. And again, I do expect that they will.
Yeah, and I go back to just some of the quotes that came out of Oakland after Marcus Semien signed with the Blue Jays and didn't return, and how like borderline distraught some of those players were that he was gone. Yeah, I think that, you know, he's made a similar impact on a Blue Jays clubhouse in a very short amount of time. And, you know, even if he only spends 1 year in Toronto, I think he will have left a lasting like impression and legacy and benefit on young players like Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Kevin Biggio and on and on. One of the big questions for the Blue Jays coming up as they get through a doubleheader coming up here on Tuesday in California, and they get through this West Coast swing, two games against the Nationals the week following, sandwiched by off days, is who comes out of this rotation. Because you got six guys in it right now. By necessity, you got all these doubleheaders, 25 games in 24 days. It was 18 and 17. Over the weekend, the Blue Jays played the Red Sox four times in the span of like 28 hours. They played Friday night, Saturday day, Saturday night, Sunday day. So sorry, 48 hours, four times in 48 hours. So I mean, it was just like the last three games were within the span of 28 hours. It was crazy. Like, it was just, they played so much baseball. These guys just played baseball for an entire weekend straight, got four games in. Everybody must be very tired today on the off day. And the Blue Jays are finally going to get through this stretch and then have to make a decision with the rotation. You already tipped your hand earlier in the podcast and said that you believe Ross Stripling will be the one to come out of the rotation when all is said and done. Why do you believe that?
He's done it before. And so, if you're a Jays pitching staff looking holistically at the whole staff and you're trying to make sure that everyone is as comfortable as possible, then, and of course, this is all things being equal, you know, we don't know the results of Tuesday as we record this. We don't know everyone's health status, but if they both go out and they have solid outings, you know, five innings, two earned runs, let's say, then I think because Stripling has done it before, because he knows what it takes to come out of the bullpen and then to revert back to his starting role, I almost think that kind of works, I guess, against him in a certain sense, because Mats doesn't have that same familiarity. So I think it's pretty easy, honestly. I think you keep Mats in the rotation. I think you move Stripling to the bullpen for the time being, knowing that he's a pro, knowing that he's done it before and has that skill set. So I think if I'm the Jays, I wouldn't spend a ton of time worrying about it. I think that's the call that I would make.
So I see pros and cons to both of them, right? Like, Stripling's done it before, right? So the pro with having it be Stripling is he has comfort with the role and he understands it, and there probably wouldn't be an adjustment period there. And he also gives you a long option out of the bullpen, which maybe you're sort of missing
right now, right? Like, you don't really have a guy out of that bullpen who, it doesn't even have to be like mop up or low leverage. It could be like a medium leverage thing where you come in and face the order once and like face nine hitters and maybe you get five, six, seven outs. Think about that Thomas Hatch rule from last season or the Julian Merriweather rule a little bit from last season. The Blue Jays haven't had that. So Ross Stripling could be that. That's a pro. A con to it being Ross Stripling is I think he's just had a better year than Steven Matz. The numbers are somewhat similar, but honestly, like the Boston Red Sox have just hammered Ross Stripling this year, and the Blue Jays aren't going to play the Red Sox again. And outside of facing the Red Sox, Ross Stripling's been really good. He's been really dependable. As a number five starter, he's done exactly what the Blue Jays have asked. Five and dive, take two trips through, keep the runs against to like two. And that is exactly what Ross Stripling has done every time out. When you look at Steven Matz and taking him out of the rotation into the bullpen, pros, he's got more velo than Ross Stripling. So he would be a more impactful sort of swing and miss, can be used in high leverage spots where you don't want the ball in play arm, right? Like this is a guy who, you know, you could probably throw out there in an eighth inning if you needed to, right? If, you know, everybody else was stretched and unavailable, you could go to Steven Matz there. I don't know. You're going to bring in Ross Stripling for a one inning, eighth inning appearance. I don't know if I see it. Cons, inexperienced with the role. So there would be probably a bit of an adjustment period there, and it would take him some time to get used to coming out of the bullpen and having his routines disrupted. And I think Steven Matz is probably somewhat of a creature of habit, and it might impact his performance or his results to throw him out of that. So I guess what I'm saying is I see it both ways, but I will feel sour if Ross Stripling loses his starting rotation spot purely because like he's going to be more easygoing about it because he's pitched really well. And I think he deserves to continue to start as long as the results are there. It just, I think you might be right. And I think it just might not happen for him. And I think it might be somewhat of an unfortunate result.
Right. And I definitely don't think you should make this call for ego reasons, but I do think the familiarity would be, you know, a factor worth kind of keeping in mind here. It's so telling really that they're in this position right now, because if you contrast it to where they were last year, a couple of years ago, now they have too many starting pitchers and they're having to make this decision. And it really wasn't that long ago that the Jays were out here telling us, you know, we would ask Charlie Montoyo who they're starting in the course of a weekend series, and he said an opener and a guy. Like that's where they were at with this stuff. Or, you know, it would be, okay, is it going to be TJ Zoik? Or, oh, you know, we think Wagaspak's on turn, so it might be him. Like they have arrived at a much better place to where they have too many starting pitchers. They have legit and look, Steven Matz, Ross Stripling, they're back end starters, right? We're not saying anything otherwise, but they're still viable back end starters, and they have six legit options instead of three or instead of two. And that's just as an organization, it's a great place to be. There's a trickle down to the bullpen. Usually these things don't last. Usually there's something that comes up and teams end up scrambling for pitching again. So in the rare moments like this one, whether it lasts for a few weeks or lasts for the rest of the season, it's something worth appreciating because it is so rare to have more starters than you have spots for.
Feels like one of those things that we're going to talk about for 7 to 10 days and it's just going to take care of itself because somebody's going to fall down his flight of stairs, or somebody's performance is going to be lacking, or there's going to be a rain out, or just something's going to crop up and happen. It's one of those things that just always takes care of itself in baseball. When you kind of look at it from the reverse perspective and you look at it from the perspective of the bullpen and what might help the bullpen more in terms of an addition of a Stripling or a Matz, I mean, what do you think helps the bullpen more and gives Charlie Montoyo a better option late in games to kind of piece his way through, say, a day when Alec Manoah is out after 4 2/3?
Honestly, I think Stripling, which is part of the reason that I think he's the guy who gets bumped, and I think that makes sense. But, you know, again, like, say, middle of an inning, right? Like, Stripling would have way more experience doing that, warming up relatively quickly. Stripling would have more experience doing that as opposed to the traditional 30-minute pregame warm-up that a starter goes through with long toss across the outfield and, you know, all those things that go into a typical start. So, you know, if I'm Montoyo, I want Stripling in that bullpen more than Matz. And for the day that Ryu just doesn't have it, for the day that someone gets hit by a comebacker and you take him out for precautionary reasons, I want Stripling to be the guy who's ready out of that bullpen.
Because I do think that the Blue Jays bullpen is still something that needs to be addressed over these final 52 games. And we're past the trade deadline now. So the only way you can address that is internally. So really the only levers you can pull are to take somebody who is currently starting and put them in the bullpen, to call somebody up from the minors to be in the bullpen, or to activate somebody off of IL because they are now healthy and have them rejoin that bullpen. Because as presently constituted, as we sit here today with Julian Merriweather still hurt, Tim Mayza hurt, Nate Pearson still building his way back up in the minors, you can't factor those three guys in right now because the Blue Jays aren't going to have any of those three guys over at least the next 10 days. You are looking at Jordan Romano as a guy who you feel good about in the ninth inning. And then beyond him, it is like Adam Simber, Brad Hand, maybe Rafael Deleas pitching his way back into leverage duty, but Deleas, a guy who not that long ago, like, you were completely terrified to show to leverage. Trevor Richards. I mean, it's just not an impressive group, and it's just a clear weakness on this team right now. And the Blue Jays need to, like, keep scoring runs at an uber high clip and keep getting these seven inning outings from their starters so that they have less leverage to throw at this group, because Jordan Romano cannot cover all of it. And for as strong as Adam Simber has been with his club since he was acquired, the ball's in play with him, man. And he is elite at limiting hard contact. Like, he's like absolutely one of the best in baseball at getting soft contact, but the ball's in play. And that is where luck crops up. That is where shift beating ground balls or seeing eye singles or little flares that drop into the outfield. That is where I lost it in the lights. It kicked off of a seam in the turf. It landed just inside the foul line. Like, all that fluky stuff, that's where that crops up. Like, that's why you want guys who strike dudes out and miss bats late in games, because you don't have to deal with any of that stuff because the ball's not in play. Just need your catcher to catch the ball, man, or block it and throw it to first base. That's all you need when you're striking guys out. I just think the Blue Jays are really lacking that high velocity swing and miss option towards the back end of their bullpen. Maybe that's going to be Merriweather, Pearson, Mayza later on in the season, if and when those guys are able to return to health and return to form. But for now, the Blue Jays don't have it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if there was that August 31st trade deadline this year, you know what the Jays would be looking for. It's still a need. The bullpen is still a weakness. It's not good right now. It was really rough, as everyone listening to this knows, in June, late part of May. It was really, really bad. Then they actually kind of made it solid. And, you know, for a while, you're sitting there, you're thinking this could be a decent group with Simber pitching so well. Richards has been a good pickup. They add Soria, they add Hand, but now Soria and Mayza are on the injured list. You know, it's right back down a notch. And Deleas walking the bases full, I don't think you can trust him at all. So it's still a weakness. It's still not in a good situation. I think the looming return, the potential return of Nate Pearson, who is listed as we speak on the Buffalo Bisons roster, I mean, that's a really interesting one to watch. And would that ever be the perfect, you know, high octane arm for this group? Because right now it's okay. It's less than okay. Right now it's below average. They are winning despite it, but you would love to have another high octane arm, and Pearson might be that guy.
Yeah, he's exactly what they need. And yeah, good call on Soria, who I completely slipped my mind because he made one appearance for the Blue Jays and then was just immediately on the IL. Yeah, Nate Pearson is exactly what they need. Just like high octane arm, velo, swing and miss stuff, mound presence, can pitch in a variety of spots, right? You could bring him in the sixth or seventh inning. Honestly, man, he could close. I mean, he can go two innings. You could use him in a bunch of different spots out of that bullpen because his stuff is that good. The thing with Nate Pearson is he's going to need multiple AAA outings.
Yes.
Like, it's not just one appearance for Buffalo and okay, you're back to the majors. Like, the Blue Jays are going to want to see him get up multiple times, get through his recovery process in between outings. They're going to want to throw a bunch of different situations at him, right? Like, they're probably going to want to bring him in one time with runners on. They want to give him a clean inning. They might want to give him a shot in the ninth. Like, they're just going to want to expose him to all that stuff before he gets to the majors. So, like, best case scenario, Ben, probably late August. Could you see it being any sooner than that with Nate Pearson?
I could see it like literally best case scenario. Let's say he makes two appearances this week and then one early the next week. And, you know, like literally best case scenario, three rehab appearances all go great. He's throwing gas. He's throwing strikes. You don't need more than three. And he's back up, you know, August the 17th or something, you know, for that weekend series after the Nationals. Like it's that's like best case, like total blue sky, best case scenario. I think realistically, yeah, toward the end of August is probably a good time to expect Pearson. And even then, that would be great because, again, you want to win. You don't want to just get to the playoffs. You want to win series. You want to win the World Series. And it's a lot easier to imagine the Blue Jays making it through October if Pearson is pitching to his potential.
And that's the other thing. It's throwing strikes. Like you're going to want him to be in the zone. And he hasn't been in the zone this year. So you're going to need to see him commanding his fastball, locating it where he needs to, throwing his slider both like tight for strikes and a bit bigger for swing and miss. Like you're just going to want to see that confidence with his mechanics and just like see him on form before you bring him to the majors. Cause you don't want to bring him up and have it be like the last time we saw him in the majors where like he walked five and didn't strike anybody out. You want to bring him in throwing strikes and feeling his best, but that's what playoff teams need, man, is guys like Nate Pearson out of the bullpen, guys like Julian Merriweather out of the bullpen, guys like Jordan Romano. And the Blue Jays only have one of those guys right now. So if they really are going to be a postseason club and they really are going to play in a wild card game and try to get to a divisional series, they are going to need bigger weapons at the back end of this bullpen. And the only way to get those weapons onto that roster now is from within the organization.
That's right. And hey, I mean, if you're going to have a flaw among the three categories of lineup, bullpen, fair, yeah, starting rotation, I mean, yeah, you probably would, I guess you take bullpen out of those three because it's really hard to patchwork a rotation together and it's really hard to win games if you're not hitting. So, you know, the Jays, again, we are to some extent nitpicking this team. Again, like they're one of the best teams in the American League. I really believe that. But they do have flaws and we see them closer than anyone probably. And I know people listening also see those flaws. And so it's worth discussing and trying to figure out where it goes from here.
Yeah, no doubt. Lots of baseball still to be played. 52 games remaining in the season. That means lots more to talk about coming weeks on At The Letters. And we will be here with you. He's Ben Nicholson-Smith. My name's Arden Zwelling. I want to thank our producers, Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. I want to thank all of you for listening, as always. Talk to you next time on At The Letters.